This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
My background, ethnically, my family's from Egypt, Coptic Christians, the native inhabitants of Egypt. They immigrated here. I was born in the United States. They came here a few years before I was born. So I grew up bilingually. I could speak Arabic, at least after a fashion, the Egyptian dialect. Later on, I also studied in college, formally Arabic and English. And I always had an interest in this, the nexus of essentially Christian civilization and where it meets Islam, as you can imagine, because of my own background. So even in history, I majored in, I majored in history. And it was basically the Near East, the Middle East, and the medieval era as well. And my first, my master's thesis was about the first military encounter between Muslims and Christians, the Battle of Yarmouk in the year 636. So obviously I've been very interested in it for a very long time, well over 20 years I've been involved in this field. I also ended up going to Georgetown University for a little while. While I was in Washington, D.C., I worked at the Library of Congress. As a language specialist for the Middle Eastern division, where I had access to so many wonderful books, including those written by Al-Qaeda, which leads up to my first book, which was The Al-Qaeda Reader. I discovered writings by Al-Qaeda back then in 2005, 20 years ago. And since then, I've just later on in around 2009, I resigned, and I basically have been a fellow at various think tanks, just writing constantly, including books about, again, these very same topics. One of the main topics being the persecution of Christians under Islam. But I've also gravitated back towards my historical interests, my sort of academic interests from way back. And that's the books that you're seeing now, basically Sword and Scimitar and Defenders of the West, where I'm essentially picking up where I left off on my master's thesis, which was the first Battle of Yarmouk. Now I'm like, basically I've been fleshing it all out. All the centuries that followed thereafter, all the conflicts and the battles and the various personages and et cetera. And, you know, I'm involved in this field in other ways as well. I give frequent talks, internationally, and I've testified before Congress. I'm involved in lawsuits that deal with Islam and radical Islam, et cetera. Yeah, so there it is.
Just very quickly, you mentioned Coptic Christianity. There's a term you don't often hear. When we talk about Coptic Christianity, what are we talking about?
Well, yeah, that's why when I mention this, usually in public settings, the next thing I say is don't ask me which precinct I work for, because Coptic, most people think I'm saying I'm a cop. The word Coptic, of course, it has a very interesting province, and I'm glad you asked. It just means, so the word for Egypt or Egyptian, the English word, comes from the Greek word, as many words do from those times. So the Greek word is Aegyptos, meant Egypt or Egyptian. So when the Arab conquerors conquered Egypt in the 7th century, they basically, I don't know, maybe they were a little lazy. They just took the middle of the three syllables, Aegyptos. They took Gypt, and Gypt became Copt. That's how it reached us finally. And it just meant a native Egyptian who was by nature Christian. So today when you say Copt, you mean an Egyptian who's Christian. So even in the word itself, it underscores how to be an Egyptian meant to be a Christian back then during the first the Muslim conquest. As a people, they're, of course, indigenous Christians of Egypt. They account for, it depends on who you ask, the numbers are very hard to get, but something like 10 to 15% of the population, which is now largely Muslim, but at one time, of course, they were the overwhelming majority in the 7th century, and they are regularly being persecuted, as comes out very often, not in the mainstream media, of course, but this, like I said, this is one of the fields or topics I follow very closely. One of my books is called Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians, came out in 2013, and so, yeah, I've been following what happens to the Copts and other Christians all throughout the Islamic world, in the Middle East, in Africa, in Asia, and so forth, and they're all experiencing the same sorts of discrimination, at the very least, and persecution in places like Nigeria, outright genocide.
When we talk about Islam and Muslims, what are we talking about? Is there an overlap with the terms? Do they mean the same thing?
Yeah, so again, with the words, Islam, one of the big lies that we got, and you know, as all good lies are, it has some truth in it, but we were told back when Islam became popular in 2001 that, or notorious, that Islam means peace, okay? And while it doesn't, Islam means submission. But yes, the word Islam and the word peace are etymologically connected. In Arabic is very interesting. It's, you know, you get three consonants, and out of those three consonants, you, depending on where you put the vowels, you can make all sorts of many different words that are somehow connected. So Islam means submit. Salam means peace. And the logic is when you submit to Islam, then you have peace. And a Muslim, we pronounce it Muslim, but a Muslim is one who submits, right? And so to be a Muslim, you know, interestingly, it didn't, again, Westerners and Christians, they project their own sorts of religious, you know, religious understanding on other religions. So I don't think they understand that the word Muslim itself, what it meant originally was basically acknowledging the political authority of Muhammad and his successors who supposedly represent Allah. So to be a Muslim had nothing to do with the condition of your heart, you know, how your relationship with God. It was literally submission to your political rule, yours being the Muslim leader at the time, Muhammad and his successors.
Would you mind taking me back a little bit?
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's my forte. So basically Islam, you know, the main thing is it gets exciting. So Muhammad, you know, the traditional story is he's born 570 and he goes.
And he did exist. One of,
of course he did. Oh, are you privy to that little conversation that I've been engaged in? Yeah, I firmly believe a Muhammad figure existed. The weight of evidence is overwhelming from if you know how history's done. Yeah, there's a guy that maybe his name wasn't Muhammad, maybe that was a title. That's all nitpicking, but there was a prophet who arose in Arabia who basically promised paradise to his followers, and he came with the sword. Okay, I mean that's clear enough because that's widely attested by non-Muslims who lived at his time. At any rate, as far as the long hagiographical story that Islamic tradition encapsulates, yeah, of course, there's probably a lot of holes in that, et cetera. But anyway, so, and then what I'm giving you is the bare bone facts, so we don't even have to go into the secondary sort, the vast questionable stuff. Muhammad preaches, you know, his religion, which is submission to Allah. Long story short, by 632, he dies, and now all of Arabia has been consolidated under all these warring tribes are now part of the Muslims. They're under the umbrella of Islam. They're the submitters who submit to Allah. For a couple of years, some of them try to break away. There's the apostasy wars. Then they're all brought back. And by 634, now they basically are really unified, and they spread out, and what history knows as the great Arab conquests begin. Okay. And long story short, so from the year of Muhammad's death, 632, if you fast forward to 732, one century, Muslims conquer all of North Africa, they conquer all of the Middle East, and they enter into Spain. And in 732, I give you that year because that's where they're stopped finally in the middle of France at the Battle of Poitiers or Tours. And what most people don't realize is all those lands that I mentioned, okay, so Greater Syria at the time, which encompassed Lebanon, Israel, Palestinian territories, Jordan, a large portion of Iraq, of course, Asia Minor, Egypt, all the way to, you know, Morocco, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, all of those were not just Christian, they were more Christian than Europe. That was the heart of Christianity, was that area in the 7th century when Islam conquered. Yeah. And, you know, so many people have sort of this fact has been hidden from them. They just think somehow those countries were always somehow Muslim or somehow like that. No, they weren't. That's why Constantine the Great, the Roman emperor, moved the capital from Rome to the east because that's where everything was. You know, you had five major centers, five sees. Only one was in the west, Rome, and the other four, Antioch, Alexandria, Jerusalem, and later Constantinople, were in the east. And all four have been conquered. So actually, if you look at a map, Islam essentially conquered and annexed and tore away three quarters of what was once Christendom. And, you know, history now just remembers Christendom as Europe, as if that was always the case. It wasn't. It was a much larger organic civilization, which was all centered around the Mediterranean. That's why it was called the Roman Lake. You know, from Egypt to Rome, that was a very simple thing. or Syria by travel, but it was all broken asunder. And actually, we can get into it, but that's what led to the Dark Ages, or at least what historians used to call the Dark Ages. Because now you had Little Europe, which was this kind of the little brother, the little Christian brother. Big brother has been taken away, and he has all the resources, all the knowledge, and now little brother's on his own. And this is when, like I said, the Dark Age begins, and you know, literacy is lost, papyrus is gone, because all written records in Europe were coming from papyrus in Egypt. And all, that's just one example. There's one historian, Henri Perrin, a French historian, who actually has a very interesting thesis, which is what I'm basing what I'm telling you on. And his book is called Muhammad and Charlemagne, or Charlemagne and Muhammad. And his whole point is you could not have Charlemagne, you could not have the rise of the Frankish Empire, all that without Islam, because it's Islamic forces attacking Europe and creating this discontinuity with the East is what led directly to the rise of Charlemagne and the Frankish Empire, which of course led to the rise of Western civilization as we know it. And so if you read some historians, and I quote some in my books, Franco Cardini, I think, he basically says Islam was a violent midwife to Europe. It really gave birth. That's how he characterizes it. And I think that's a pretty applicable, apropos characterization. So anyway, these attacks go on. And like I said, so much has been conquered and taken away from Christendom. And then they resume again. And the Mediterranean islands are all conquered eventually. You know, places like Sicily and Malta had Muslim presence for centuries. Rhodes and Cyprus and all these places. Spain had Islam in it for about 700-800 years. Okay, and that's the whole Reconquista. So you have the holed up Christians after it got conquered in 711. And they're living in caves in the northwestern quadrants of the peninsula, and they start slowly, century after century, fighting back until around 1492. And Muslims are still there longer. But then you have the rise of the Turks, which was an even more traumatic impact on the Christian world. They eventually become the new standard bearers of Islam and jihad. They take to it in ways that the Arabs never did. And they essentially take over from the Arabs. So for a while, you have the Turks, who are actually sultans. That means they're the rulers. But they keep the caliph in the Abbasid caliph in Baghdad. They keep him as a figurehead for, you know, basically until the Mongols stomp him to death with their horses rolled up in carpets, I think in 1258. But the Seljuks, they now renew the jihad, and they take over, or the Turks, they take over Asia Minor. And Asia Minor, again, like I said, was one of the oldest Christian territories. This is where St. Paul sends his letters, many of his epistles. And it's now Turkey, right? What's good about that, or not good, but we have a lot of relevant sources, because the closer you come to our time, we have more reliable sources with numbers, as opposed to the 7th century. It's really shrouded in mist. But when you look at the, you know, around the 11th century, when the Turks are taking over Asia Minor, you have chronicles that talk about literally tens and hundreds of thousands of Christians, Armenians, Syrians, Greeks being butchered, massacred, enslaved. Thousands of churches being desecrated, burned, torched, crosses being broken. So the religious hostility is there. Okay, you know ISIS, the Islamic State, and how what they do, what they say, and then we're told that has nothing to do with Islam. So what I'm telling you from the beginning, it's all been there. Okay, all that stuff, even worse. ISIS on steroids, basically, is what I'm describing for centuries. And that's by basically now we're in the year 1070. So 1071 is a major battle, the Battle of Manzikert. The Turks win. They defeat the Eastern Roman Empire. And now they're right in front of Constantinople, right across the strait. And this gives rise to the First Crusade, which was called for in 1095. And I just find it amusing, because if you talk to someone about the history or the history of conflict between Muslims and Christians or Muslims and Europeans, it'll start in their mind. It starts with the First Crusade. Yeah. And that's by design. That's very intentional.
And there's a very famous quote.
Yeah, exactly. So and there's a very famous quote from a professor, Georgetown professor, who I knew, John Esposito. And I've quoted it so many times that I think I can do it verbatim now. But if not, it's paraphrased. But he writes, literally, 5 centuries of peaceful coexistence elapsed between Christians and Muslims, until an imperial papal power play called for a series of so-called holy wars against Muslims, causing centuries of distrust and resentment from Muslims to Christians. So he's saying that before the First Crusade in 1095, everything was peace amongst Muslims and Christians. But look what I just told you. Muslims literally carved out three-quarters. They conquered three-quarters, 75% of what was Christian world, and constant persecution. You know, one of my favorite examples is just in 1 year, in the year 1009, okay, so a little over a century, less than a century for the First Crusade, you have one caliph, a Fatimid caliph centered in Egypt, who, according to Muslim sources, destroyed 30,000 churches in Egypt and Syria, which on the one hand emphasizes what I'm saying, which is that area was very Christian in the early centuries when Islam conquered it, and it also emphasizes the persecution, okay? 30,000, that's a hefty number, including the most important church or basilica or cathedral in Christendom, the Hagia Sophia, which was built atop the resurrection site of Christ in Jerusalem. All right, that too was destroyed and razed. So, and yet, according to my, and here's the big confusion, most modern historians are peddling this idea that everything was fine until the First Crusade, that there was no reason for the First Crusade, that it was just a bunch of imperial papal power play, like I said, and would-be colonizers and just adventurers who decided to go to the Middle East for no reason and just start killing Muslims. And since then, Muslims have been upset at Christians, and it's just the complete opposite. Even if you look at what Pope Urban II said to rile up the Crusaders, or the Emperor Alexius, the Roman Emperor, who sent letters asking for help, it's exactly what I said, and even more graphic. All it does is talk about what the Turks and the Muslims were doing to Christians, the persecution, the rape, the like sadistic abuse and torture, disemboweling boys and women and raping them on altars and pouring their blood in the baptismal font, etc. Yeah, really, really bad stuff. I'll stop right there. You wanted a quick tour de force.
So, what was the goal, the game plan then of Islam? It seems just aggression and annihilation of Christianity.
Yeah, you can say that. The goal, the open goal of Islam, which comes out in the Quran, it's in the Hadith, it's codified by the Islamic scholars known as the ulama, is that Islam must, its destiny is to rule the world. And what that, and that is done by jihad, which is armed struggle. And, you know, one of the mistakes is some people used to say that Islam's goal is to convert every last soul. No, you don't have to convert to Islam, but it has to have political authority over the entire globe. And then you have three choices. You as a non-Muslim can embrace it and become a Muslim, and now you have all the same rights that Muslims have. Or you can pay jizya, which is tribute, and this goes back to Quran 929, means you pay money, and you also embrace a host of discriminatory lifestyle measures. You can't build churches. You can't fix churches. If a Muslim comes and wants your seat, you have to give him the seat. The two Christians' testimonies equal to one Muslim's testimony in a court of law. You know, obvious discrimination. So you have to embrace and accept that if you want to keep your religion and pay a special tax on top of everything else you'll be paying. And also endure sporadic persecution that rises now and then, which still goes on all throughout the Islamic world. Or you reject payment of tribute and you fight. Okay, so let's say in the Middle East and those regions that I discussed that got conquered in the 7th century. So the Christians there eventually opted to pay the tribute and live as second-class citizens. In Europe, they didn't, and they fought back. Well, in Spain, they also got conquered in certain areas. But by and large, Europe took the third option, which is fight. Okay, and that's what it was. So yeah, I mean, the death and destruction is part and parcel of the jihad. But its goal is essentially, again, just world hegemony.
So far, historically, Islam and Christianity have not been compatible.
Well, no. and that's the irony because, again, one of the big lies is we get all these so-called ecumenicists or, you know, who try to tell us, especially Christians, who try to tell us that, oh, Islam, you know, it's such a brother religion and we have so much in common. People like Pope Francis, for example, is very famous for doing this. And the game they play, again, is they'll say, look, you know, Muslims believe in Jesus. And they do. In Islamic teaching, Jesus was born of a virgin and he's perfect and he performed miracles. Okay. But the problem is they don't, of course, which is all good. But the problem is what What Muslims do is they appropriate the religious figures of Jews and Christians, but then they recast them in a way to validate themselves, Muslims, and demonize Jews and Christians. Okay, so for example, when it comes to Jesus, Muslims don't believe in the most important things. They don't believe he was crucified. They don't believe he was resurrected. They don't believe he died for the sins of man. They don't believe he's the Son of God. So that's much more important from a Christian doctrinal point of view than what they do believe. And that creates conflict because that's actually taught in the Quran. And in fact, the reason Christians are bad is because they say Jesus is the Son of God, and that's why they must be fought. So obviously that is more problematic than saying they believe that Jesus was born of a virgin. So their Jesus is really not the Christian Jesus. Even the names are different. Isa is his name. Okay, but I'll give you another better example. So for example, a lot of the people who claim that there's a lot of commonalities, it's called the Abrahamic religion. So they say that Judaism, Christianity, and Islam are brother religions. Okay, and the reason they call them Abrahamic is because all three sort of trace their roots to Abraham. Okay, so now we know, let's say the Genesis account of Abraham, we know what God calls him forth and he goes through, the promise, try to find the promised land, etc. But in the Muslim account, it's the same thing, but then Abraham tells his former people, his former kin, blood relatives and tribe, how there's nothing exists between them from now on but hatred and enmity and war because they don't believe in Allah. Okay, well, that's not in the Bible. Okay, so that was added, and that gives Muslims, the impetus to hate and war on Christians and Jews and everyone else. So they take Abraham because, and they want to. The reason they appropriate all the biblical figures is because Islam's the new kid on the block. It's the newest religion, and it's trying to associate itself with these figures of antiquity, which all religious people believe in. Okay. But then they use it for themselves to make the Christians and the Muslims. So when Jesus comes back, for example, Isa, on Resurrection Day, which sounds good, sounds Christian, the first thing he's going to do is break all the crosses, cancel the jizya, and kill all the pigs. Okay, and he's breaking the crosses because he's finally fed up with these crazy Christians thinking that he was crucified. And he's canceling jizya means no longer can you be a Christian or a Jew and pay tribute. Now you either have to be a Muslim or die. Okay. And well, yeah, killing some swine because Islam just hates it, to keep it all together there. So you see what I mean? It's like, so to me, this is, I always give this analogy of imagine someone who says, hey, I know your grandfather and he was my grandfather. And, that sounds on the surface sounds, oh, we're related. But then he tells you, and everything your grandfather said was wrong, what you think he said. I know what he said. And it's the exact opposite of what you thought. And then you find out everything that your grandpa supposedly said was not what you thought he said. So to me, that doesn't build bridges. That's an appropriation of a people's heritage and then twisting it in a way to actually attack them with it.
The crusade, the Christian aspect, was a defense against the attacks. Is that correct?
Yeah. Again, because they show the Crusades in a vacuum, they don't tell you what was happening. They don't tell you that the Middle East was Christian. They don't tell you that the Muslims were persecuting the Christians there and elsewhere. So it just, all you know is you just see a body of Europeans leaving Europe and going to the Middle East and killing and fighting Muslims there. So on the very, on the surface, it's very obvious this is offensive warfare. And these people are invading Muslim territories. But they knew, and especially the religious authorities of Europe understood that all that area was once Christian, that all that area still has all the Christian holy sites. Holy sites were very important to pre-modern men, okay? And that Christians were being killed and slaughtered. So it was a just war in their mind. It was defensive. Sure, on the surface, they were traveling there. But again, that was under, for example, King Louis, Saint Louis, in his crusade, because most of it was centered in Egypt. And there's one point in the text, and they talk about how when this country is brought back to Christ, okay, so it's very clear they understood that Egypt was a Christian nation. It was part of the, it was part of Christendom. So it was definitely not just a just war, it was a holy war, essentially. This was a thing that God wanted, at least from the context of the time. Now, again, everything is done to make it look like it was a complete offensive war that had nothing to do with what we're talking about.
A Muslim is an adherent of Islam, and Christendom and Christianity are the same thing. Is that correct?
Yeah. A Muslim, like I said, is a follower of Islam, one who submits to the religion of submission. And Christendom is it's a later made word, and it just meant, you know, the Christian body politic, basically. Right. As if you can think of Christianity as an empire, you know, its own, all the lands that are connected together, which again, historically, after the Muslim conquest, meant Europe. So to say Christendom was essentially synonymous with Europe. But I'm one of those who's advocating the idea that no, Christendom was for centuries much, much larger. And it was mostly in the Middle East, or what we call the Middle East and North Africa, because that was the main Christian region. Sometimes some people even use the word Islam-dom as a sort of corollary to Christendom, meaning the same idea. Mm-hmm. But,
Is it accurate to say, therefore, that Christianity and the West are synonymous?
Yeah, well, sure, the West, the West, I always find it interesting because if you look at civilizations today, they're known by names. So you have the Hindu civilization, you have the Buddhist civilization, you have a Muslim civilization, and then you have the West, and it's only known by direction. And I think that's also by design. So we live in a direction. Everyone else lives in a substantive civilization that centers around a religion, but we're a direction. There's two interesting aspects to this. One is I believe that's by design, and it's sort of it was spearheaded by the secular mentality of the West, because they don't want to, you know, they don't want any connection to Christianity, so they just call it the West. We're West from, you know, everyone else. Okay. The other interesting thing is, you know, what became the West was also, again, all that was left over after these major Islamic conquests. So if you think of the large map, which includes all of Europe, but also all of North Africa and all the Middle East, and all that gets swallowed up, well, what you have left is the West. So the West, that term was used even in pre-modern times. It goes all the way back to the Greeks. But it was sort of because that's the area that, you know, is still different from that area. And most of the East has its own kind of sort of almost monolithic mentality. Even the pre-pagan, in the pagan times, with the coming of Islam, some people will say it's very similar to it because it's just a sort of, you know, almost like a tyrannical sort of god who's whatever. So we live in the West. Everyone else lives in a civilization. But also the West is accurate in that the West is the westernmost region of Christendom that was never conquered and that actually kind of spread out from it later on.
Well, just adding to that, and also dovetailing with the all the incursions and the conflict chronology, when you talk about Islamic incursions or Islamic attacks, you're not talking about an ethnicity. You're talking about the majority of a particular region following that belief. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that's a good point, because most historians, for example, when they talk, let's say they talk about the conquests of whatever, you know, they'll talk about Arabs, then they'll talk about Berbers entering into Spain, and then they'll talk about Turks and various iterations of Turks. There's the Seljuks, the most famous are the Seljuks, and then certainly the Ottomans later. Okay, and then they'll talk about the Mongols, who are known in the sources as Tatars. And all these groups had wars with Europeans and wars with others. And so if you read it from a national point of view, it just seems like, okay, just one tribe fighting another. But what I find interesting is all those groups that I mentioned were all Islamic, okay? And when you really delve into the primary sources, especially the Muslim ones, the actual chronicles written by those peoples, the Islamic impetus is there. In other words, all of them make at one point or another some kind of reference to the point that we're attacking the Europeans or the Christians because they're infidels. And because Islamic law requires it, and we destroyed their churches, which is a good thing, and we enslaved them because Allah promises us slaves, and it's okay. And that's what I'm trying to say. If you look at it, they're all different nationalities, and historically, that's what academics do, and that's why you never hear about Islam. Mm. You just hear, okay, there was this one group, Tamerlane, you know, Timur the Lame, who's probably the most savage warlord of history, who created, you know, pyramids of skulls. You'll never hear that he was Muslim, but he was. And according to his chroniclers, a lot of what he was doing was jihad. Okay. And so that's how Muslims understand it. So that's why I try to bring it out, to show that, yeah, they have their national identity, which is true, and they have their own peculiar characteristics and idiosyncrasies. But the Islam impetus is always there, right beneath the level, and it's documented.
I forget now which book. I think it might be, is it Crucified Again? You point out terms like, let me try attempt, tahiya. I hope I'm saying it correctly, which means license to lie, if I remember correctly. But not just that, there are a bunch of these terms that they use to justify very bad behavior.
Yeah. Takeya is one of them. And it's amazing the amount of deception that Islam allows. Islam is very much the religion of the end justifies the means. Okay, so if the end is the subjugation of the world to Allah's law, which sounds good from a Muslim point of view, the means to get there can be very flexible, okay? And they do include lying. So, for example, jihad historically has meant armed struggle, all right? But the word itself means, I always find it interesting because people will tell you that, the apologists for Islam will tell you that, you know, you shouldn't translate jihad to holy war because it just means struggle. And they're right, but that makes it worse. And I'll explain. So the reason Orientalists and earlier people translated jihad into holy war makes sense because in the pre-modern era, to struggle for Islam meant warfare against non-Muslims. That's it, okay? But now in the modern era, when that's not really possible because the Islamic world is actually much weaker, bear in mind that the period that I'm talking about from the pre-modern era till the 7th century until, let's say, 1500, 1600, 1700, Islam was the powerhouse, not Europe. They were the weak horse. They were the ones that were expected to be conquered any moment now. They were the impoverished ones, all right? So that's why jihad was just warfare. Now that Islam is essentially weak compared to the West, compared to the world, okay, financially, economically, militarily, jihad struggle continues, but it takes on different guises. So even according to Islam's, you know, the shiuch or the sheikhs or the ulama, they've classified different forms of jihad. And I'm translating them in my head, but basically jihad of the tongue, jihad of the pen, jihad of money, jihad of the womb. And what all these mean, basically jihad of the tongue and jihad of the pen are basically license to lie, propaganda, anything you as a Muslim can do to help Islam, whatever its image, or to weaken and demoralize the infidel. Okay, you do it through your pen, through your tongue. Jihad of the money means you're a rich oil tycoon, Saudi or, you know, Arab Gulf Emirate type person. You spend millions and millions to support the real jihadists. You fund them. You sponsor them. Jihad of the womb, this is one of the most popular ones, also known as the baby jihad, is just the idea of procreating and literally outbreeding the infidel. And that's happening in Europe. They actually say that you have mosque clerics telling men and the women to have as many babies as possible so we can outbreed them. And it's working. All throughout Western Europe, in some of the major cities, I think London, several, Oslo, and Norway, the number one name is Muhammad. That's amazing. That's very telling, right? So you have all that. And so you have these different manifestations. And the Takeya, like you mentioned, that's, again, one that's so well. Muhammad himself, who's supposed to be in Islam, this perfect figure, justified lying in three cases. So any Muslim will tell you. And they are, you can lie to your wife to make her happy about something. You can lie to two quarreling parties in order to reconcile them somehow. And you can lie in war, of course. War is deception. All right. But he's also on record saying, if I give my oath, but something better comes along, I'll annul my oath. So a lot of license. There's clerics out there who talk about another even more problematic doctrine than Takeya. It's called Tawriya. And what this means is it's perfectly okay in Islam if I give you sort of a half-truth. So let's say you need to borrow some money and you say, hey, can I borrow, you know, $10? And I tell you, I don't have a penny in my pocket, but I have $10. I haven't lied, even though you think I'm saying I have no money.
True.
I literally don't have a penny, but I do have $10, okay? But by saying I don't have a penny and getting you to believe that I have no money is legitimate in Islam, okay? So, yeah, these are all the things that not many people are aware of.
But now you mentioned the immigration issue in Europe. It seems like an unstoppable train.
Yeah, you know, yes and no, I suppose. Europe's forebears, the ones before them who actually fought tooth and nail to keep Islam out, managed to do it. The reason it's unstoppable, and a lot of people, again, they miss it. It's not the Muslims. In this case, it's not the Muslims' fault. Okay, Muslims are always trying to come with their swords and spears to conquer, historically. In this case, it's the European leaders who are allowing this, 100%. You can't blame the Muslims. Muslims want a better life, and a lot of them are not jihadists. A lot of them are migrants. They just want a better life. I get it. So that's why millions and millions of them are going. But they're not getting in there by force. They're getting in there by these European leaders who are doing everything to bring them in and to support them. So really, that's the main issue that people need to be aware of. In this case,
Why are the European leaders doing that?
Well, that's a good question. You know, I don't know. Is this just political correctness run amok? Is this they're trying to show how tolerant and wonderful they are? Or is it a little more nefarious? I think the latter. I think there's an agenda obviously involved. Maybe in the early stages, 15, 20 years ago, 25 years ago. But when you see how bad it goes and how horrible it's getting in all these areas that have large Muslim migrant populations have become essentially almost war zones. And, you know, regular European people are being attacked and it's crime ridden and rape and grooming gangs, etc. You should have stopped it, but they seem to have accelerated it. So obviously there's some nefarious agenda. Some people say globalization, trying to just mix all the people together. Maybe it's the way for the secularists to destroy Christianity, because a lot of times where you bring a lot of Muslims, the first thing that happens is Christians have to suppress their holidays because they don't want to offend the Muslims. Okay, so Christmas, for example, has to be suppressed, et cetera, et cetera. So that too, I'm sure, figures amongst these elitist thinking.
Yeah, that's an interesting comment. There was a talk that you did, which I listened to. You spoke about political correctness. People are too scared to say what you're saying.
Yeah, they've been conditioned. They're too scared. They don't want to say the wrong thing. And it's even worse. I mean, the political correctness is one thing. You know better, but you don't speak it. But I think people have just been so indoctrinated that they can't even see reality anymore, that it just doesn't even make sense. I suppose that's what you would call wokeism. You know, it's a severe case of extreme political correctness where you actually believe the nonsense. But yeah, it's from what I'm learning or seeing, England has become just amazing. It's kind of like you can't even speak anymore. I think if you declare yourself an Englishman and proud of England and you wave the St. George flag, you might get arrested. Okay, but if you go around with a Hamas flag, and you know, that's fine, and the police protect you. If you point out that there's grooming gangs and there's certain people behind it, you know, you might get arrested. So this is Orson Welles 1984 type thing, but real extreme form versions of it. Where who'd have thought we'd get to this point? Or a country like England, which was once a bastion of free speech, right? It was okay to have free speech when it was all about cursing Christ and, you know, urinating on the crucifix. But now when it's Islam, everything has just changed full circle. So it becomes obvious that there's definitely an agenda involved, that there always has been.
You don't hate Islam.
I don't like Islam, but I'm fine with Muslims, and I make a distinction between them. Islam is a body of teachings. It's an ideology, okay? Muslims, you know, there's, 1.7 billion of them, and they find themselves associated with this ideology for any number of reasons, most of them simply because they were born into it. I'm not going to hate someone for that. And most of them don't even know. Honestly, a lot of them don't know what I'm talking about. They just know the bare minimum, which is the five pillars of Islam, okay, you know, prayer, fasting, pilgrimage, etc. And a lot of them are very good people. I don't hate Muslims, but I am talking about the dangers of Islam itself as an ideology and those who align themselves and follow it closely, which in modern parlance is radicals or fundamentalists, right? But to me, it's actually real Muslims, real Muslims. So again, there's many, many, the Muslims that we call moderate are really just secular Muslims, right? there is no moderate Islam. There's no, you know, there's this good Islam and a bad Islam. There's just Islam. What I've been telling you is standard Islam. That's why when I say, for example, ISIS and all the stuff that they did, which was horrific, and everyone told us and everyone believed, that has nothing to do with Islam. But if you look at the historical record, as I've been saying, and as in my books, especially Sword and Scimitar, you're going to see that Muslims have been acting that way from the very beginning. In fact, a lot of what ISIS says and does is patterned after Muslims of history. Famously, they would say something like, we've tasted American blood and none is sweeter, okay, which sounds kind of just gross and sensationalist. But that actually comes from one of the very earliest jihadists or mujahids, who was at the Battle of Yarmouk, which I told you about my thesis. And he said, we've tasted Roman blood and none tastes sweeter. So they're copying him. Also, you know, the famous where they decapitate people in orange jumpsuits, 21 Coptic Christians and many others. That's actually choreographed and closely patterned after what Saladin did to the Knights of the Temple in the hospital after the Battle of Hattin in 1187, for example, because it's described in detail and it's exactly how ISIS does it. So basically the long and short of it is Islam is what it is, and it's a violent force. Muslims, like I said, could be, you know, whatever they can do. There's Muslims who say, look, I don't believe in what you're saying, and I believe Islam means peace. Good for them. I'm not saying they're liars, but that's for them. They're not impacting anyone else. That's them, and that's fine. But, you know, there's no mosques that really do that, certainly not in the Islamic world. And I'll leave you with a final analogy. Maybe you've heard it, but I always do it. It's the Nazi paradigm. So the whole world is fine saying Nazism is an evil ideology. It's racist. It's white supremacist, whatever. But we also know that there were men and women who were Nazis, but they were good people. The main one being Oskar Schindler, right? He was a formal ranking Nazi member who went out of his way to help Jews and other undesirables from being killed, right? Now, how do we understand that? Okay, was he following a moderate form of Nazism? No one says that. Everyone says, yeah, he was part of it. Nazism's evil, but this guy did something good and he rose above that thing because he's a good man. So that's how I submit to you I see Muslims and Islam. Islam is a body of teachings that is violent and inherently intolerant to the non-Muslim. But there are Muslims who do good things. They're there. They exist. I know. But they're doing it not because they follow a moderate form of Islam, just like there's no moderate form of Nazism. They just do it because they rise above those teachings and they're good people. So I don't hate Muslims, but I am wary of Islam.
But then is Christianity's Achilles heel being too tolerant and forgiving?
No, I would say its Achilles heel is not that it is inherently tolerant and forgiving, but rather we're living in a day and age where everyone, Christian and non-Christian, is convincing Christians that that is what Christianity is. But it's not, because historically it was much more robust. It was balanced. Yeah, you have turning the other cheek, you have forgiveness, but you have a whip of cords and you have tables being overturned in righteous indignation. Okay, and you have laws and you have rules and you have just war theory, which predates, it goes all the way back to Augustine. But it actually arguably goes to Christ and John the Baptist, because that's who Augustine points to. You know, when the centurion came to Christ and asked for him to heal his servant, and Jesus did, what does Jesus always do after he performs a miracle? He tells that person to repent, right? Do this, do that. To this centurion, he didn't tell him that. If anything, all he had was praise. Why didn't he tell him, quit the military? You're in charge of a brutal Roman, you know, you're a centurion in charge of these 100 men and all you do is kill people. He didn't say that, because it was understood that laws exist and physical violence and force is part of enforcing laws. So no Christian had a problem with that. I would say to you, though, that now in recent times, it's been so emasculated intentionally to weaken Christians. And a lot of the ones who are doing this are non-Christians who will pay Christian organizations to sponsor this idea that to be a Christian is to be a doormat. Because, of course, that's great. If I'm a non-Christian, I'll love that kind of Christianity. If you, as a Christian, think your entire religion revolves around turning the other cheek and forgiving me and helping me, by all means, even if I hate Christianity, be a Christian and spread it, because that's the best thing out there. But historically, that's not how it was. It was very much balanced. These crusaders who went to war, they were Christians, okay? And they knew, in fact, they would cite the loving your fellow man as reason to go to war, because Jesus said the two greatest commandments, love your God and love your fellow man, right? And they would cite that. We love our God. That's why we're going to liberate the Holy Land, because like I said, holy places are important. And we love our fellow Christians, so we're going to go help alleviate their burdens at the hands of these Muslims. So, yeah, I would argue that Christianity is not inherently passive, but it has been turned into that, and for a reason.
I know that you are pressed for time, so if you come in for a landing with a final message, what would that be?
Well, since we're talking about Islam, it's just simply for people to, you know, wake up. Too often what happens in the world is there's this incremental thing where, you know, I like to talk about the boiling frog analogy. And for whoever doesn't know it, it's the idea that if you throw a frog in a boiling water, he jumps out because he feels it. But if you put him in cold water and slowly warm it till it boils, he sits in it until he dies. And I think in many ways that's reflective of what's happening to Western civilization. Because if you look every decade, it just gets worse and worse and worse. And none of the stuff that is that, for example, let's look at the transgender, you know, all that insanity. I was watching a video back in the 60s where they're warning against homosexuality. Okay. Teachers are threatening students about, you better watch out from these homosexuals. And in California, I couldn't believe it. And I'm thinking, imagine in that climate, if you said, hey, there's a million genders and I'm a she and he's a he, you know, you would have been laughed out. No one would have done it. But what they did is it happened incrementally. First, they normalized regular homosexuality. And, you know, then it was all over the media and it was in the sitcoms and they became very sympathetic figures and all they wanted to do. You see what I'm saying? But then generation after generation, until we get to where we're at, until where it's supposed to be some great victory that our president, Trump, signed in a law. That's not a victory, man. That's an embarrassment. Okay. For the chief, the chief of the United States to spend his time putting a law that every child already knows. Okay. But it just shows you how bad we've gotten. And I think the same thing is happening with Islam. It's spiraling. It's getting out of hand. It's gotten to the point. Why is a place like Europe, you know, Europeans and white people are about 4% of the population of the world. Why is it only them that have to give up their land and give up their heritage and their culture and their religion to appease everyone else? It's mind-boggling when you think of it like that. But if it happens, generally, you know, slowly and incrementally, you just get used to it. And I think that's where most people are. So they need to sort of rise above it and kind of objectively see what's happening in the world.
Just quickly, you mentioned the frog in the boiling water. Do you know anybody who's ever actually tested that?
No, and every time I look it up, there's someone who's saying, you know, it's not true. It doesn't happen if you do it.
And nobody wants to be the first guy.
Either. Yeah. No, I haven't tested it. I'm just using it as an analogy. Yeah. I don't want the human rights group to go after me. So.
Yeah, nobody wants to be that guy.
No, I don't want to be that guy. But I'm sure there's been a lot of those guys. So it must have been tested.
Raymond, how can I follow your work?
Thanks, Jeremy. The easiest place is go to my website, raymondibrahim.com. It has all my articles and it has links to my books on Amazon, Defenders of the West, Sword and Scimitar, etc., and all my videos and my fledgling small YouTube channel where I occasionally make little videos.
If you enjoyed this, please visit germwarfare.com.